a live or dead animal reported at 151. CHP is going to poke him with a stick, see which one he's alive or dead, alive or dead. Hour number one of the Dr. Future Show, straight ahead.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, welcome to Future Tuesday. Dr. Future, Mrs. Future in the studios.
Hello, everybody.
Should we send out the KSCO drones to investigate that animal on the road?
Yeah, poor thing.
Oh.
Let's hope it's a rescue animal.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
One of the things about us humans is, yeah, we see everything going on out there that's so sad. You know, animals in the freeway and stuff like that. But we can do something about it. That's part of having free choice, right? Like, avoid those animals. Celebrate their life. Make it easy for the animals to live here, too.
Exactly. You know, we do have a really good animal story this week, too. And I wasn't going to lead with it, but since we're talking about animals,
okay. Perhaps
it might be a worthy focus.
I guess that's why it's on my mind, you know.
You think so? Yeah, because we went so deeply into this.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll start with it because there are some other more relevant news articles. But I mentioned this because I found this piece because it seemed to be relevant to all of us. It's a study by scientist Eric Green, professor of biology at the University of Montana, who had built a roboraptor,
a robotic owl
in this case.
Yeah, so a raptor is a kind of animal that's a bird of prey, right? Basically,
right. Any
kind of bird of prey is a raptor.
As far as I know.
Yeah. Okay, so we have a roboraptor,
okay.
In this case
and
an owl.
He put it in a forest environment near his home and let the other birds out there see it. There have been a lot of bird noises. When he put out the roboraptor, the yard hushed, completely silent as the other birds checked it out.
Like, don't make a move. There's an owl in the yard.
Right.
Be careful.
And then he said soon birds begin to arrive from throughout the neighborhood and looked at it. And they kind of went around the owl and they kind of mobbed it and started making noises, chickadee sounds. Some of the birds were chickadees. And his recorder were capturing all the ruckus. He was delighted because he says for birds, this is like a riot. And there's a whole set of acoustic stuff that's just associated with predators. Dr. Green's fascinated with the language of birds and what they're communicating to each other. And he says there's a lot of information that is in these sounds that the birds are saying to each other.
So these birds were all jeering at the owl, huh? Just kind of mobbing him, ganging up on him, like, get out of here. We don't want you around here.
Well, apparently the chickadees do that. The chickadees, when they see a predator, instead of just running and hiding in the bushes, which is often a very good strategy, the birds will mob the predator and
safety
make lots
numbers,
of sounds.
Kind of thing,
yeah.
Huh?
Mm-hmm. He says by studying these things, what's interesting is that he said that animals such as birds and mammals and even fish recognize the alarm signals of other species. He said some even eavesdrop on one another across classes. Hmm. For example, red-breasted nuthatches listen to chickadees. And dozens of birds listen to tufted titmice, who act like the forest crossing guards. And even squirrels and chipmunks will eavesdrop on birds, and they'll add their own thoughts to the mix.
Wow.
Which is pretty neat.
Yeah.
So they wanted to understand the nuances of these bird alarms. What Dr. Green has found so far is that there is a kind of a language of the forest, and that it's not just a warning that there's other birds in the area. But that it's actually, they are sending a lot of information, like how big the predator is and where it's located. And often the other birds will pick it up and pass it on in a wave. So literally a bird call will move 100 miles an hour across a forest, alerting birds of predators. It's cutting edge stuff to listen to all these sounds and listen to interspecies communications.
And so it's kind of like there's this wave of birds picking up the call and passing it on.
Right.
That just shoots out.
Yeah.
And so everybody in the neighborhood knows that there's a dangerous bird coming in.
It's kind of like a dance of alarm signals to warn of danger. his interest had look at in subtle bird alarms came with the studying the lazuli buntings. And he said in that case, he had been showing them the robotic owl. Sometimes they would stop responding to the artificial calls of his robot owls, and instead they would ignore it, and then they would dive into the bushes 4 or 5 minutes later, and a Cooper hawk would cruise by, which means that they were paying attention to alarms that were spreading from other birds and responding in advance. It's pretty cool. It's a phenomenon called the distant early warning system among birds.
And which ones are the, what did you call them, the crossing guards? The little security crossing guards? What are they doing? I mean, are there like little crossing paths in the forest that these birds are standing on? What does that mean?
Well, some of the birds, for example, will warn that there's a predator in the field, and they say, don't go into the field. Basically.
Oh, I see.
You know, there's a field there. You don't want to go there.
Right. Stay in the forest. Yeah. Don't go in the clearing. You'll be dead meat.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he says the birds actually know enough about each other's signals to whether or not to ignore it or not. Mm-hmm. The raptors are not so great at high frequencies. Mm-hmm. They hear in lower frequencies. And so the little chickadees are up in the 6 to 8 kilohertz range. Outside of the raptor, they have like a private channel of communications where they're able to talk to each other and warn each other, and the raptors don't hear it, which is kind of interesting.
Wow.
They also can tell when a bird is too large, or when they can listen to a chickadee and they can hear what kind of predator is coming in the area. Say a crow can listen, and he can say, oh, I'm not too worried about that owl. You know, that owl's too small for me, uh-huh. The pygmy owl. Apparently, the birds know what kind of a raptor is coming and where it's located. And the other species can identify that information as well and know whether or not it's worth paying attention to or not.
Mm-hmm. And didn't you tell me something about how, like, the birds are more threatened by birds that are close to their size because they have the same maneuverability? And so they'll have a sort of a more significant warning for, say, a little bird that can hurt them than they would
exactly
for a bigger
what I'm
bird.
Saying. Raptors tend to be the biggest threat to birds nearest their own size because they can match the new maneuverability of their prey. So like a large goshawk might only merit a chickadee from a nimble chickadee. Well, that little pygmy owl will elicit a chickadee followed by 5 or 6 little D symbols after that.
That's really cool.
So they really, there's a lot more going on there in this bird. Apparently squirrels understand birdies quite well too.
Uh-huh.
And like when red squirrels hear a call announcing a dangerous raptor in the area or they see a raptor, they'll give calls that are acoustically almost identical to the birds.
Oh, wow. Hey, listen, it's time for our first break. So stay tuned for more of the Dr. Future Show. We've got this and more fascinating stuff for you. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Other interesting news this week, SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket is now certified to fly NASA space missions.
Yay! Elon Musk is going to start flying us to space.
Yeah.
Getting closer to Mars every minute.
Well, SpaceX now has a Category 2 certificate.
Category 2, which
permits the U.S. Private Space Agency to fly medium-risk NASA space missions.
Oh, like expensive science projects.
Satellites and probes. So far, the company has only transported cargo to and from the ISS, the International Space Station.
Uh-huh.
So the company will now be allowed to carry satellites and space probes.
Woo-hoo! Trust.
The agency has an aggressive schedule, which leads up to actual crew flights to the ISS. Mm-hmm. The Dragon capsule's first crewed mission is scheduled for 2017.
Oh, boy. That's before the Martian experiment group from Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Way before that.
Heading off to Mars.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. But that's
the Falcon that's flying
story.
Some
this
astronauts
is more
to the International Space Station,
uh-huh,
maybe. Or at
right.
least around the planet. Maybe not to the space station.
Well, by the earliest 2017, they'll see an orbital test flight with 2 pilots of the Dragon spacecraft. And that would cap a series of test milestones that SpaceX would complete before obtaining certification to ferry the ISS crew.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great. We're moving forward with that. The missions are medium risk as they only involve transporting relatively less critical cargo and satellites. And it took them 3 years to get that certificate.
Yeah, I think a year ago we were reporting on the lawsuits happening because they were not allowed to submit a bid, you know, that it was a no contract, no bid operation, and they sued to get the right to make a bid. So I'm glad that they're in there.
Yeah, their first project with this new certificate is a joint project between France and the U.S. Called the Jason 3 satellite. And that will go up. The Jason 3 will launch from Vandenberg on July 22nd.
Wow, that's not very far.
Yeah, not too bad. Mm-hmm. Now, their competitors is Boeing. Boeing has created what's called the CST-100, and they're developing their own commercial crew transporter. And they're on track to launch space crews in 2017. So 2017 will be the end of NASA's sole reliance on Russia's Soyuz ferry craft.
Just in time, boy. Yeah. Cannot wait much longer.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, and welcome, John, to the studio.
Thank you.
John just arrived and is ready to add his point of view to our stories.
Yeah,
today.
So let's give John a minute here. So, John, you were pointing at your hat. Tell me the significance of
this hat. Well, a Jade Helm 15 is after veterans. They got the more recent veterans that swear their allegiance to the president instead of the Constitution.
And you're a Marine Corps veteran, right?
When I was sworn in 61, mm-hmm. I've sworn in to do all things to protect the Constitution. That was all number one. Now it's not there anymore.
Really? What happened?
Really.
So the military now swears NDAA. Allegiance to the president?
Yes, that's right. They don't swear to the loyalty to the Constitution anymore, but just to obey the president.
Uh-oh.
And that's Jade
that's
Helm.
That's not constitutional.
Well, that's no, for the Jade Helm exercises.
They're worried about the earlier veterans that we might have guns, we might fight against them.
What do you think of all this stuff going on in Texas?
I'm proud of them. This first time I've been proud of Texas for a long time. I would like to talk to Jerry Brown about what he's got to say to Obama to make clear what kind of tyranny is going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think they're doing open carry weapons in Texas. There's some new legislation.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there were some pretty amazing interviews just in the wake of what happened in Waco about the biker gangs not just being international criminal conspiracies, but also biker gangs, some of which have a few law enforcement members who are actually bullies just as much as the other people that we're talking about in this current shootout, and that the whole biker gang culture is now coming into the forefront of public scrutiny.
Well, they're brave.
And how to separate out the criminal component from the trusted true Americans.
Right? That's right. But any bikers I've ever known that were very patriotic, in spite of all their craziness.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, apparently the thing that's being tested is, it's hard to describe it, but the callers from the NPR show that I was listening to were describing how the COCs, the Coalition of Clubs, would have board members who were connected to organized crime, and these Coalition of Clubs would be basically preventing people from wearing membership patches unless they paid dues. And, you know, the whole thing just sounds very much like a racket, really. Anyway.
Protection rackets. I mean, there's nothing new here. This is 50s Marlon Brando, as Charlie said. You know, I mean, come on, let's get into the future here. This is like really ridiculous. This is like going back to, I mean, this, you know what this reminds me of? Maybe this is a little extreme, but I just saw the Mad Max movie.
Yeah.
The new one out. It kind of reminds me of, I'm like, do I really need to hang out there? You know, as a futurist, isn't most of civilization beyond this?
That's a future we'd rather not have.
Yeah, come on. Do we have to waste our airtime on this?
Probably not, but we do have a caller.
Okay.
But
bleeds it leads, right?
Yeah, let's see. Let's put our caller on hold, and I'll happily add him to the show.
Yeah, go ahead. When he's ready.
Yeah.
All right, since we're talking about criminals and all the really evolved parts of the future here, let's talk about the new how the new Prius. The batteries are being stolen from the new Priuses.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, here you go.
We're trying to get into the future with like a highest potential of humanity living sustainably on the planet. And what's happening? Criminal gangs are stealing Prius batteries.
Battery packs. They weigh 120 pounds. You could easily electrocute yourself if you're careless in taking them out. They've actually been being stolen in San Francisco area. One was on a downtown street in the city in front of a church. It takes about 20 minutes to steal a battery pack from a new Prius.
Did somebody film this procedure? Is this happening in epidemic proportions, or did it happen once?
No, it's happening quite a lot.
Oh, dear.
Actually.
All right, well, listen, totally move into this, we do have a call.
That's fine. I'm done with that.
Hi?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Richard from Pacific Grove, welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
How you doing?
Good.
I just thought it was interesting. I just turned my radio on, and you were talking about the biker gangs. How upset everybody is, and, you know. It's almost kind of delusional, the way we do things in this country.
Yeah.
The biker gangs, we've known they've been there for a long time.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And they deal in drugs, and they do this, they do that. But yet, they're not the ones that have put our country in the dilemma that it's in right now, you know?
Right.
It's so funny, you know?
We didn't
hold anybody accountable for bankrupting the country. Now we're going to pick some guy that, here we go. Let's get the biker gang.
Yeah, it's a nice diversion. Something else to think about besides the important stuff.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is I'm not surprised that this is happening at all.
Yeah.
And I'd be real curious to know how many of the guys that are the bikers are veterans, you know, and recently.
Quite a few of them, from what I've heard.
Yeah. A lot of them are veterans.
Yeah, apparently the gangs actively recruit them because of their knowledge of weaponry and various tactics, military tactics
that
are useful.
Well, that's what I was impressed with them. In a sick way, I was impressed with their sharpmanship, okay? In other words, there was a gang battle a few years ago in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And everybody was shooting, everybody was stabbing, and only two people died. Well, this shows you that these guys were organized.
But Texas is an open carry state. I mean, you're going to have a whole lot more guns in Texas than you're going to have in Nevada.
Oh, these guys carry guns, trust me. There's always somebody designated with guns, and they knew they were going to a rumble.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But in Texas, no, you're totally correct. But, you know, this is like the Wild West after the Civil War, you know?
Like Mad Max.
Think about it.
That's what I was thinking.
But again, you know, the other point is, once again, this is a diversion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's terrible what happened, but the real problem is, look, what we're letting happen in Iraq, well...
Yeah, the Ramadi, that's crazy.
The real problem is we're wasting our wealth on unnecessary violence around the world.
Everyone knows that basically the wars are kept going because it supports a bunch of companies that provide war materials. It's really not that complicated.
Yeah, Dr. Future, I got to tell you something.
Yeah.
We love warfare. Okay. We as human beings love warfare. Warfare.
But don't we love other things more? Don't we love other things more? I mean, I think that this era of fascination with warfare is unprecedented. How come we don't give equal time to the other fascinations such as civilization?
No, because from the beginning of time, even when we had Neanderthal people, they were going around slaughtering each other. No, warfare has always been a way. In fact, some people... In fact, there's a great book that's been written about. I got 10 seconds for you, my dear. We got to run,
but that's a good thing to reflect upon when we listen to the news.
You want to hold on? We'll be back in 3 minutes, or you can call back.
Okay,
great. All right, thanks. All right, folks, you're listening to the Dr. Future Show, and we're going to go to our break and be right back.
Hey, guys.
Hey, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, we were just talking about the motorcycle gangs and how a war is endemic in our species, and we have a caller that just wanted to make that point. You still there, caller?
He's still here.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
You wanted to kind of put your own spin on that.
Yeah, I wanted to. Yeah, I was saying, yes, it is an issue. We do come from violent monkeys, and we have this DNA that needs to be evolved. And, you know, there are lots of ways to do that, and, you know, I'm all for discussing how we can do it, but to revel in the fact that we have a violent past isn't the way to move forward, in my opinion.
Well, I'm not trying to revel it. I'm just trying to be realistic.
Yeah, you have to be realistic and see how to change things, you know.
But we're not going to change things unless we deal with violence and we deal with our love of the military and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing, you know, it's funny because you hear people that they always talk about, violence is bad, blah, blah, blah. We shouldn't have guns. We shouldn't have this. And the first time they, you really look into it, you know, they've got their private security guard, they're carrying guns, they've got somebody working for them that is carrying guns. You know, it's a false sense of righteousness, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's a dangerous world out there. Now, the book I was talking about, which I can't remember the name of right now, I'm sorry, yeah. I just got it. But his whole premise is that if it wasn't for warfare, okay, mm-hmm. nothing good would have come of our civilizations because we would have been broken up into all these, well, like what Yugoslavia was, or like what Iraq was, okay? Mm-hmm. The only way those places were kept in order was by a dictator, somebody who came down and slammed hard on them.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, look at us, you know? We've got pockets of neighborhoods throughout our state, the country, you know? And if it wasn't for law enforcement or whoever you want to call it, our armies, all right, mm-hmm. the places would be on fire all the time. Isn't there another way of looking at it? You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I appreciate that. And we have evolved. We have created a civilization where we actually can be relatively safe most of the time.
Only yeah. because we have warriors in the background with big guns.
Yeah, we do have security, and that's a good thing. I would agree. We have security so that we can be relaxed and focus on doing new things. You know, it's like yeah. one is needed for the other to exist. You know, I absolutely
exactly,
would agree with
exactly.
that.
Yeah, that's all my point was. It's like, yeah. you know, I mean, in any culture, if you go back to primitive Africa, I mean, you know, all the cultures, who do we say, wow, you know, I want to be a warrior. I want to be a warrior. Right? We don't say, I want to be a teacher. And, I mean, no, we want to be a warrior. And
yeah.
we have parades for warriors in every culture, every society.
Well,
and I'm not saying it's
I
good
have
or
a,
bad. It's just the way
a distinction sure. for yeah. you, Richard, which mm-hmm. I like to point out to my mm-hmm. my friends. Yes, we have to respect the perspective of the warriors, but there's two kinds of warriors. There's aggressors, and there's defenders, which basically, like the ideal police, are more like defenders. Like when there is an aggressor who is a bully who doesn't have respect for people around him and wants to violate our rights. That's what the laws are for. The laws are to contain the aggressors who are not doing what the public will wants. And that's why we have law enforcement, is because the buck has to stop somewhere. We can't just let the bullies run the planet. So unfortunately, it gets muddy because we discuss how do we trust our defenders not to be the aggressors. And that's really the conversation.
We don't no longer trust our... defenders anymore. I mean,
but we do. We trust some of them.
I trust the local police and the county police. All the ones I've ever met are beautiful people and care about us. And about, what, a year and a half ago when those two policemen were killed by the criminal, I saw a cop go by up here by Gales, and I saluted him, and he saluted me back because I love and respect these men.
Yeah.
Well, no, and you do, and I do as well. My father's a retired policeman. Most of my friends are policemen back in New York. I understand it. But because of what we've been seeing on the news, the way reports are coming out about all the problems we're having, you know, people are starting to lose respect.
Well,
and
it's the classic thing of the bad apple giving the good apples a bad name. And we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need to come up with ways that the bullies in the police department are kicked out of the police department and the police get the respect that they deserve.
And
yeah, well, and again, I can go on for days for this, but it's not only the respect out in the street. We're finding out that in my little town of Pacific Grove, you know, the pensions have bankrupted our city, you know, between the police and the firemen. They're not looked at with the same awe and respect that we used to look at them. Now we're looking at them as this is money-making deal.
Yeah,
and
well,
when they stop you for a $350 ticket, now you're starting to get resentment built up.
Yeah.
It's true, but that's because the people managing the money have screwed up the money. Anyway, you know, we have some other headlines.
I'll bet
that
you do.
Dr.
I'll bet you do.
Thank you for
good
the call, though.
Yeah.
Really, good stuff.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
And I appreciate the fact that we, as a civilization, have fought hard to the freedoms that we have so that we can look at these other interesting things that
we're
creating.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Yeah, thanks, Richard.
Okay.
Great, bye.
Okay, then. I want to show you an amazing thing that happened. This is a totally different topic, okay? You don't mind if I change
back
it.
To the future.
Yeah.
Take us to the glory world here, dear.
This is grassroots future. This is Kickstarter project. There's a program called CHIP, C-H-I-P, like the California Highway Patrol, but means something entirely different. It's the first $9 computer.
Oh, this is so
all right.
Cool.
Now, this is interesting. This is another crowdsourced people thing. They were trying to raise $50,000 to build a $9 computer, you know, a thing that works kind of like the Raspberry Pi, or, you know, being able to surf the web, check your email, play games with Bluetooth. $9. And they were trying to raise $50,000. They have 17 days to go, and they've raised $1.469 million. Million.
Everybody wants a $9 computer.
Right. Out of 50,000 they're trying to rain. 1.469238. You know, and 28,160 people to create that $1.4 million.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
It is. And I looked at that and I really thought about if I needed a $9 computer. And it turns out that the main perk is actually a $100 package that gives you the $9 computer plus a mobile housing screen plus an adapter that plugs into your VGA or your USB or
HDMI.
So it's got a few little add-ons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it is this little tiny gum chewing stick size of a chip that can be plugged into any screen, can be plugged into any keyboard, and can...
It's just remarkable.
Send you off running.
Yeah. So I thought that was very interesting. Also, you should know that Google has been green-lighted for their self-driving vehicle prototypes. Now, these are specially designed cars. They're not retro-equipped Priuses like their
the
previous
ones. Like the ones we've been talking about.
No. These were specially designed cars to be fully autonomous, self-driving vehicles.
Do you have a picture?
I do. These are all on our website at drfutureshow.com/links. You can look at all the pictures there. They are putting these on the road this summer. Yeah, this summer. The prototype vehicles that they've created will be leaving the test track and hitting the roads in California.
All right, look around
Mountain
View.
Mostly in the Silicon Valley
area. You're going to see it.
Yeah. They're going through rigorous testing procedures. They've also had an existing fleet of Lexus RX450Hs, which are SUVs.
Mm. You know, this little prototype Google automatic vehicle looks a little like a smart car.
It's a neighborhood-friendly vehicle, kind of slow. They're two-door, and they have a little knobby thing on the top that has the radar in it.
They kind of look like Volkswagen Juniors.
Yeah, they look very friendly.
Don't mind me, I'm just a little car bot.
Yeah, right. You can push me around. Now, let's see, the other breakthrough this week is from the University of Texas, is a new centimeter-accurate GPS system.
Centimeter-accurate GPS. Okay, so who's using it? What are they going to do with it?
Why would you want a centimeter-accurate GPS? Well, it will revolutionize geolocation for many technologies. One are virtual reality headsets. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, you could be wearing a headset and running around in your backyard and feel like you're climbing hills and doing things. And it's like a holodeck, you know, like it feels like you're in a real environment and it's really accurate as you move, as you walk around.
Sure, up to a centimeter. So you can like pick up something in your hand.
Yes, it could allow unmanned aerial vehicles to deliver packages specifically to a particular location on your back porch.
Uh-huh.
In terms of the autonomous cars or some of the more sophisticated features of a regular car, it could enable collision avoidance.
Uh-huh.
So collision avoidance technologies on cars would become possible with this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
With a smartphone, it could be used to build a globally referenced 3D map of your surroundings. And that would expand the radius of a VR game that maybe you're playing in with multi-users.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. Right now, GPS is maybe 3-foot accuracy.
Uh-huh.
You know, so to go to centimeter accuracy is huge.
Right.
So instead of sitting in front of a monitor and playing, you're, like I mentioned earlier, you're in your backyard. You can actually be running around with other players.
Uh-huh.
It's quite a breakthrough. One of the ways in which it works is that it becomes aware of the antennas that are in your smartphone.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it can see your
positioning
smartphone
system. It knows exactly where,
And so it would be able to identify all the players because they would all be wearing smartphones with little antennas.
Or the antennas, the little antennas that are particularly important. They're able to leverage low-cost antennas to reduce the cost of centimeter accuracy. I mean, we do have centimeter accuracy technology now. Military uses it. Surveying and geology companies utilize it, but the survey grade antennas they're using are way too large and costly for use in mobile devices.
Yeah, you're not going to put one in your backyard if
no,
you can
so
avoid
this
it.
Makes it economically feasible for mobile devices.
Uh-huh.
So the team at the University of Texas Austin Cockrell School of Engineering have spent the last several years working on this and creating a specialized receiver called the GRID, which extracts the information from low-cost antennas so that it can work.
Cool.
Anyway, very interesting article. Samsung is helping to finance this, by the way.
Oh, a Samsung centimeter geolocator.
Right.
Beware. They're going to be looking for us.
Okay. Fascinating stuff.
Listen, let's go to a break, and we'll be back. You're listening to the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, indeed. Our guests have arrived for the next hour. That's great. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll be able to talk to them about some fun things. Other interesting news before we get to our guests. You know, we have a probe that recently crashed into Mercury. It's called Messenger.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes, Messenger. Mm-hmm. Boy, what a way to send Mercury a message, huh? Really trying to get your attention there, fellow planet.
Well, before it crashed in, it collected a wealth of data and images that map the planet's gravitational field.
Hmm.
And there's a couple little takeaways that I think I mentioned to you. Before it crashed, this data was collected, and we're just beginning to analyze a lot of it. A lot of it is still pretty raw. The scientists on the team have announced that Mercury's magnetic field appears to be about 4 million years old. 4 million years old.
Wow.
That's not that old, you know, for a planet.
Well, isn't that pretty close to how old the Earth is?
No, Earth is 4 billion years old.
Oh, I'm just not paying close attention. You said
I said 4 million years old.
Okay, so
that's nothing geologically.
4 million years old.
Yeah, so something happened 4 million years ago.
Gravity.
Yeah, magnetic field. Mm-hmm. Magnetic field.
This magnetic field.
Not gravity, magnetic field.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mercury's core is massive. It makes up 85% of its radius.
Hmm.
It's a huge core. The planet's crust is thinner at the poles and thicker at low latitudes. And that suggests that the planet's outer core is actually liquid.
Hmm.
This is interesting to contemplate, but the scientists are concluding that just below the planet's surface, it's liquid. Liquid iron sulfide.
Hmm.
Isn't that curious? Other interesting elements of it is that elevation changes on Mercury's surface are far less extreme than on Mars or the Moon. In a volcanic plain in the northern latitudes of Mercury, there's an observable uplift caused by the formation of this plain. It doesn't have as big mountains. It's more flatter.
Well, you know, especially it's so much of it is fluid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it's going to be like the oceans, right? It's going to have a relatively uniform surface.
Relatively uniform. It's liquid.
Right.
It's liquid underneath it.
Right.
The magnetic field of Mercury is likely as strong as Earth's, albeit one that has decreased considerably. The source of the magnetic field is the core's liquid metal.
Hmm.
They also explain that the Mercury's maintenance of its heat, despite its small size, also contributes to its magnetic field.
Hmm.
Very liquid planet, really close to the sun.
News
I guess that heat is,
Mercury.
Yeah, very interesting. We'll be getting more and more information as they analyze the data. But already it's something that we really didn't know much about.
Yeah, I've certainly never really considered what the middle of Mercury was made of
before. That its core is liquid and 85% of the planet is the core. Crazy, huh?
Yeah.
We also have a new radio telescope array that was developed by a consortium at Caltech. It's now in operation. It's a new super powerful radio telescope operating at the Owens Valley Radio Observatory. Now, what's unique about this radio telescope array is that it has the ability to image simultaneously the entire sky at radio wavelengths with unmatched speed. The entire sky. So it helps astronomers search for objects and phenomena that basically pulse, flicker, flare, or explode.
Wow.
Across the entire sky all the time.
Hmm.
Anything that pulses, flickers, flares, or explodes, you'll be able to see with this new array that monitors the sky 24/7.
Hmm. And it monitors the entire sky.
Yeah,
I guess
at the same
other
time,
arrays just monitor a little patch
little pieces
of the sky.
Of them, right. But mm-hmm. remember, it's looking for pulses, flickerings, flares, or explosions anywhere
right.
in the sky.
Right. Things that were there, then disappeared, then came back again.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's already getting unprecedented videos. And astronomers are hoping that they'll piece this together to give a more of a complete picture of the early universe and learn about extrasolar space weather. And that's the interaction between nearby stars and their orbiting planets. And then the consortium of this includes scientists from Caltech, JPL, Harvard University, the University of New Mexico, Virginia Tech, and the Naval Research Laboratory.
Sure.
So they see the entire sky at once, and they image everything instantaneously. Isn't that interesting?
That's fascinating.
See, observing power of more than 250 antennas spread out over a desert area equivalent to about 450 football fields. It's uniquely sensitive to faint variable radio signals that's produced by pulsars, solar flares, auroras on distant planets.
And I guess those things travel through the planet? It's looking at the whole sky?
The whole sky, yeah. A single radio antenna would have to be 100 meters wide to get the same sensitivity. And to give you a comparison, the giant radio telescope at Arecibo in Puerto Rico is 305 meters in diameter. However, a telescope's field is governed by the size of its dish. Even Arecibo, as big as it is, can only see a tiny fraction of the entire sky. This is an array that sees the entire sky at once.
Wow.
So it's best of both worlds. It's offering good sensitivity and an enormous field of view. It basically produces 25 terabytes of data every day. It's one of the most data-intensive telescopes on the planet. Well, it is.
Wow. You know, terabyte an hour, just about.
5,000 DVDs to store one day's worth of the array's data.
Yes, that's why they call it terabyte.
Right.
One day worth of Earth data. One terabyte.
And they have a supercomputer developed just to do this.
Uh-huh.
Fascinating. That's now in operation.
Excellent.
Also very significant is a new battery.
New batteries.
You know how I love batteries.
You love new batteries.
Now, what's really interesting about this is that it is a micro battery, a 3D micro battery, that actually fits onto a microprocessor, right onto the chip itself. Yeah. It's a large-scale on-chip integration that basically combines the battery with the chip.
That's going to be a really tiny battery.
Very tiny battery. It's called 3D holographic lithography. At the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. It's a very high-performance 3D micro battery for chip integration. It has exceptional performance. It has many applications that include transmitters, distributed wireless sensors, actuators, monitors, portable implantable medical devices will be very likely use this sort of thing. It's very parallel to the way energy works in biology. Like with cells, the batteries are on board. Every cell has a battery, the mitochondria. And so in a sense, we're replicating the way cells work. Now, these microprocessors have gotten sophisticated enough that they are like cells, and they now have their own battery source with this type of technology. They don't need an external battery source.
Well, I guess we're going to be integrating a lot more kinds of cellular activity as this technology improves.
Yeah, their ability to have high-energy materials on these batteries was core to this. They are able to have good cycle lives, lots of energy, and it allows you to be capable of operating pragmatic, practical machines.
Lithium batteries, these little teeny tiny elements.
Yes.
Just lithium and hydrogen giving us electricity.
So in the future, these 3D micro batteries will all be on board the microprocessor itself.
Yeah. I wonder how long it'll last. How do you change the batteries when they're that small?
Well, they'll probably recharge, right? They're lithium ion.
You have to feed them probably something.
Yeah, you probably will. You probably will have to do all kinds of crazy stuff to need to use them. But they solve a lot of problems with batteries that are currently, because batteries right now are a very different science than the microprocessors. Batteries are usually this gooey stuff that quivers and, you know, and it's like a very different world. It's like dirty stuff, and compared to this clean microelectronics that's nice and sweet and wonderful and this gooey stuff. it reminds me of biology. So the combination of these two into a single organism, if you will, is significant.
It's a big breakthrough.
Yeah.
ultimately, isn't everything we do pretty much copying biology?
Well, we
whether
are.
It turns into new people or new machines.
Yeah, right.
Oh, sorry, John. There you go. What about Transcendence?
Transcendence with, you know, our favorite actor.
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp puts his consciousness into a giant computer, and when he's about to die, and he becomes part of the computer.
Yeah. Well, brain uploading and all that good stuff,
yeah.
Still used in the future, but certainly many people are thinking about that.
That's our destiny. That's our future.
Exactly. Meanwhile, there's also evidence that electrical stimulation accelerates wound healing. I thought that was very interesting. We're basically a society that's focused on drugs for our health care, but more and more research is showing that electromagnetics can also be used for helping to heal us. New findings at the University of Manchester show how electrical stimulation accelerates wound healing. They did a study with 40 people. We have that up on our website. We don't really have time to go into that in detail right now, but we will have that for you to look at www.drfutureshow.com/links. Just
all
go
right.
to Dr. Future Show, or just search for Dr. Future. You'll find us that way.
All right, and what do we got coming up for the next hour?
Next hour, we have two of our favorite Dr. Future Show correspondents, Richard Cray and Greg Panos, who have been covering some events going on that are of interest to us, including the Maker Faire this last weekend.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Dr. Future Show on KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas.
Hour number two of Dr. Future, straight ahead.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. This hour, we're going to be talking about some of the cool events going on in the Bay Area that suit our sensibilities. The Maker Faire being one of them, and a virtual reality conference being another. And in the studio, we have a couple of our regular irregulars, correspondents, Richard Cray and Gregory Panos, who have been attending these events and will be giving us an update. So welcome, you guys. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey there.
Yeah, right.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw you at the Maker Faire. It was the most crowded I've ever seen a Maker Faire.
And the happiest.
The happiest, yeah.
Everybody's smiling. That was my favorite thing.
It's held at the San Mateo Fairground. For the uninitiated, how would you describe the Maker Faire?
It's a huge gathering of individuals, basically the kind of environment that you would go to a county fair and have rides and popcorn and pony rides and the like.
But here,
it's nothing like that.
But there, the ponies are all made out of like
rockets.
Plastic 3D printed parts and
robots,
yeah, right. Servo motors,
and welded bike parts, reconstituted tires.
Right, and the cotton candy is spun kale grains and
printed on a 3D printer.
Organic.
Yeah, I actually had
bananas.
Some 3D printed pancakes.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
How were they?
Shaped like
I saw that.
Shaped like
shaping?
A rocket.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
I saw that too.
So they,
that was very cool.
That was called Pancake Bot.
Yeah, it's very famous. So I put that up on my Periscope feed, and people were responding to that. They'd heard of the Pancake Bot.
The booth was way in a corner, and it was a very popular booth. All the little children all hanging around there looking with frowny faces, waiting to have their Pancake Bot thing come out of the printer.
Right. Different designs, and very cool.
And right near it was a 3D printer that allowed you to print in multiple colors. It combined several forms of plastic into one thing that you could make. And typically, 3D printer plastic has been one color, so I thought that was pretty cool.
I like the Google breakup booth. Google had a booth where kids could stand with safety glasses on in front of plexiglass box, and then they would either blow up things or crush things.
Hmm. I missed that.
So I saw it was like six kids that were standing on a platform with safety glasses on, watching two metal arms come together to destroy a VHS cassette tape.
Oh, yeah.
And their parents were standing behind them, and you know, they said, "I don't even think they know what that is."
I don't know what it is. Just destroy it.
So they had a high-speed camera that took video of it and then projected it onto the screen. You could see it. And they also had a balloon that would blow up inside of a plexiglass booth. then they recorded the sound and played it back in a slow motion, and it sounded a lot like whales.
Really? Balloonics?
Like a Frankenstein groaning. That's behind the door of a
balloons
closet.
Of the sea.
But I like that. And they were also like smashing figurines, little figurines. And I thought, wow, that's where a lot of my grandmother's figurines could have gone. To.
Into the Google Smash Bay. Huh?
Well, you know, they have those big car crushers that they recycle cars over at the recycle lots. They had a couple of mini ones, and they smashed cassette tapes and all kinds of ceramic dolls and things, and then I had the high speed cameras going so you could see how it all sort of deconstructed in the last moment.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that does tie in with how much our culture loves smashing things and destruction. And
kids love them.
Yeah,
look,
kids love
them. That was so part of the entertainment, is just watching them.
Yeah, I mean, there was the Game of Drones, too.
Yeah, right. Game of Drones. We were talking about
another
that.
Popular attraction.
Yeah, I was thinking the Game of Drones was not as entertaining as it could be, because the drone would fly up in the air, and within 3 seconds, they would knock each other out, and they'd be down.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, the Game of Drones was really like a lot of waiting and not much action.
They should have it more like wrestling, where it's choreographed, and they have a whole show, and they don't need to tell anybody.
Well, I think they should have a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
For those who haven't seen this, this is like a large netted area where you have drones that fly, and then spectators on stands outside of the area rooting the drones on. They have two teams usually. The rules are two drones come in, one leaves.
Right.
Right? That's the only rule. And they're supposed to be able to take them down. Though at the Maker Faire, they curved it back a bit, because apparently outside of Maker Faire, they use flamethrowers on drones and paintball guns. That sort of thing. And they don't allow that around a lot of people you have at the Maker Faire. So
I think the Game of Drones would be improved if on each drone, they were able to understand where they were in the three-dimensional space and relative to each other drone.
Yeah.
And as the drones approach each other, you hear music beating faster, drums, cymbals being added as they get closer to each other. And then when they actually hit each other, it triggers a little tape loop of an explosion sound. So, you know, everybody in the audience is being inundated with all this audio, this choreographed audio that's being triggered in real time by the movement of the drones and the impact of the drones.
That'd be very creative.
Yeah, because all you really hear is you hear buzzing, zzz, and you hear a snap when one hits another. Yeah, right. And then you hear some pieces
splat.
Crack apart when it hits the ground. And if people are all shouting, you can't even hear that.
Yeah.
So there need to be some drama and some theater added to it with multimedia.
Actually,
makes sense.
I think all you drone heads need to come up with something more interesting to do with drones than
destroy
drone
them?
Battles.
No, yeah. That's right, yeah.
It's so stupid take your flight skills and do nothing other than aim at another drone.
Well, the coolest thing with the drone is to put a camera on it and get that.
That is one of the killer apps.
That,
the first,
you know, it's eye in the sky perspective that you can get from a drone.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And flying them with the headsets on, where people don't actually see reality except from the point of view of the drone. You know, the drone pilot is flying with the headgear on. You ever seen that?
Yeah.
That looks like the new frontier.
Right, having folks, it's time for our first break. Dr. Future Show on KCL. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Mrs. Future in the studio at the controls. John Monahan listening currently. Our two guests, Greg Panos and Richard Cray. Three out of four of us were at the Maker Faire this weekend and are quite excited about what we saw there. We were just talking about the Game of Drones, which is where two drones go into the arena and one leaves. Very interesting. However, there's a lot more going on with the drones than just destroying them.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I did see some really interesting new drones that got my attention. I'm particularly interested in the micro drones myself, the very small little micro drones. The most interesting one I think you showed me, Greg, was called Crazy Fly. Crazy Fly, which is actually...
Yeah, you know, Greg actually pointed out that little drone at NAB down in Las Vegas.
Crazy Fly?
Well, it was a different one.
But it was very similar.
No, there's Micro Drone 2.0, Micro Drone 3.0, and Crazy Fly 2.0. This is what this one is. Now, what's interesting about Crazy Fly is that it's a flying open development platform.
So it's not a toy that's been manufactured in China. It's made to be soldered and changed and things added to it.
That's right. It is a Swedish company called Bitcraze, B-I-T-C-R-A-Z-E. Their website is bitcraze.io. It's an open source, Linux-based flying computer, basically.
But you need to speak Swedish to program it.
Can you put a camera on the microdrone?
Oh, yeah. Really? Yeah, they have cameras on it. You see, where this opens it up. It's very interesting. Right now, we're just basically destroying them with each other as entertainment. But with flying computers like this, we can start having synchronized flying, for example. We could have a half a dozen of them doing figure eights in the sky.
Right.
They could be shooting lasers at each other and reflecting lasers to other ones and creating complex three-dimensional geometries with a little smoke effects. It could be quite engaging.
Like right, Busby Berserkly.
Busby Berkeley.
Yeah, you could do Busby right. Berkeley effects
so, yeah.
easily.
Like Esther Williams swim, yeah. synchronized swimming lots with
right.
drones.
Lots of leggy supermodels emerging upside down from the pool.
I think Disney has yeah. some patents on that.
Really? Well, you know, there were some really interesting synchronized creatures in the dark room that had just kind of, there was a dome that had all yeah. of these little rocker arms on it, and then all of the rocker arms were moving in groups. It really looked like the whole dome was alive with its little cilia network on the outside. There's no reason why all of these mechanical devices, which are getting their control signals from a controller, can't be coordinated together, right? Mm-hmm. Like the same controller could be getting them all to do the same little dance.
So there were a lot of things at Maker Faire about the IoT, or the Internet of Things.
Right, that's a big buzz term we've often bantered around on our show, right. too, the Internet of Things.
Right, so your refrigerator and your toaster,
the classic things, yeah,
and
yeah.
your garage door opener, you know, will all talk to each other and give status information.
Right, right. What did you see that was out of the usual this year?
Proliferation of new microprocessor-based Internet of Things cubes and chips and the like, which would be used to piggyback onto regular things, making them Internet things.
Mm-hmm. So anything can become part of the Internet of Things once it's tagged.
Yeah, it's about monitoring, really, especially when you want to be efficient. Like here in California, you know, we're running out of water. Mm. People are starting to come up with aha moments over ways to monitor and watch water usage and water waste and inform them of it or have it automatically mitigate its usage in order to preserve the water. So computers that talk to each other and have small lists of things to do when they're told or informed of a condition that would trigger any of those tasks on the list are very well suited to handling things that we don't want to be bothered with. We can't think of or we're too busy.
So elaborate drip water sprinkler system kind of thing, except instead of just turning on a tap, it redirects water from your toilet or something.
Yeah, or robots aware that someone's about to flush the toilet and it lifts the top up and it jumps inside the toilet to displace a lot of the water that it doesn't need to use.
You like to make it entertaining as well, huh?
Right. It takes a little bath at the same time. Saves a gallon or two of water displaced by its core. Jumps back out and climbs all over the bed.
We saw
off.
The 3D printed robot InMove. Was that the name of it?
Yeah, InMove. Was
InMove.
InMove.
Anthropomorphic robot. It was all the parts were 3D printed.
Yeah, it looked like a human.
Was that the green robot?
It was white. It looked kind of like white R2-D2 made out of plastic.
And it actually started as prosthetic hands.
That's yeah.
And when we encountered it, it was off. And he booted it. And it went through its whole activation sequence and boot sequence while we were standing there. So it was in verbose mode. So it would say everything, each little system that was powering up and checking out, it would report verbally.
Right.
So it says checking right arm rotation. And then the right arm would rotate and go, pss, 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 pss. Checking left arm rotation, pss, pss, pss. Testing visual cortex. And then the head would move around and sweet. Went through 30 of these things. I mean, it really took a long time.
Yeah.
And he looked at his hand when he was moving
right,
the digits.
Right. Put his hand right in front of its face and moved its fingers.
Wow.
So it's getting its vision systems running. And I thought, gee, you know, what a wonderful opportunity to entertain people, to accelerate and to add music and all sorts of things to this boot-up sequence. It's actually fun to watch it come alive. And if it's sitting in the corner, you know, it's not making jokes, it's not entertaining anybody, isn't singing. So turning it on is half the fun.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Remember what that was called?
InMove.
InMove?
InMove. InMOOV.
MOOV. Huh. Well, very cool.
So it reminds me of a robot activation sequence from the movie Judge Dredd when Rico goes into the pawn shop and reclaims his military robot and gives it the activation sequence. It's the ABC robot.
In the original Judge Dredd?
Yeah, and this thing, I mean, it starts blowing steam, and it's sort of very sort of a steampunk robot. It talks, and it's asked for commands, and he gives it commands, and it just sort of lights up. It's almost frightening. It's about a two-minute segment. You can find it easily on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's an example of a Hollywood company that wanted to make an effect of booting up a robot that was part of an interesting part of the story.
Yeah, very interesting.
That could be learned.
On a pragmatic level there, I saw a 3D printer booth that was creating prosthetic limbs for people who need them. Mostly kids doing 3D prosthetic. Very limited compared to the expensive ones you might get at a VA hospital, but ones where you could have interchangeable limbs that could do different things. They cost about $50 each.
But I think they're extremely functional, though.
Very functional, yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know, speaking about things for kids and prosthetic limbs, there were so many craft lab benches all around the Maker Faire for kids to just sit down and try and do something. And one of the really cool ones was a cardboard robot manufacturing bench where kids were being shown how to cut out cardboard and create these cardboard hands and then create like joints with strips of tape holding strings that would like pull the cardboard back and forth so it would move like a hand. There were just all kinds of ways that the kids were given hands-on opportunities. There was another really cool one of these girls. It was called Butterfly Light. And Butterfly Light was a kit which basically taught girls to put an LED light onto a hearing aid battery and then attach that to a little butterfly and just have a butterfly light. So, let's see, on the Maker Faire stage, just learning opportunities that I thought were really fresh and interesting, there was a nerd book author who had created a playbook where on one page you would like take a strip of copper and you would glue it down on the page to make a circuit. And then after you had made the circuit, you would turn the page and you would draw something that would be a part of a story about creating that circuit. Mm-hmm. So it was basically teaching kids how to do electricity and then getting them to be creative with it. It was really great stuff. So.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, a lot of these kids are, this is their first opportunity to be exposed to the idea of disassembling and understanding the order of things and remaking them.
Absolutely.
Okay, we got to go to CBS News for a moment, and we'll be back with more reports on evolutionary stuff happening in our own backyard.
All right, stay tuned. You're listening to the Dr. Future Show.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We've been talking about some of the amazing things that were on display at the Maker Faire this year. And on display isn't really the best word for it because, like Burning Man, it is an interactive participants event.
Very kinetic, you know.
Yes.
Over here there's a band playing. Over there there's some strange vehicle driving by with flames spewing out of the top of it. And
right, that's Richard Cray, by the way. Richard Cray and Greg Panos are two special
3D
guests.
3D printed jewelry.
3D printed jewelry that you could design your own. Right, and Mrs. Future has one with her. Well, my goodness, that is really nice. It's like gears within gears within gears.
Yeah, a little Antikythera, you know. This is just a little kit for putting together wooden jewelry. That's three pieces that are just a pulley system, really.
Yeah, it's all beautiful. Gears. Yeah, it's pre-computer. It reminds me of steampunk,
right,
which was a big topic.
It looks
well.
Very Looks very, very expensive.
It looks very expensive, but it wasn't.
$20
Like $20
Yeah. So the steampunk thing was quite effective too. You know, steampunk. Now, how would you describe steampunk? 19th century technology is as if Jules Verne technology went into the future.
Yeah, it's from the steam engine era,
right,
when the steam engine was the hot new technology before trains.
Right.
The beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So it's really kind of like a throwback. But everything was made of metal and gears with like leather strips to move gears with axles and wheels and...
Yeah, there was a giant truck that was in the shape of a rhinoceros that you could climb up inside of and look out all over. And there was a giant snail vehicle.
Was the giant octopus there this year?
No, that wasn't there, but they did have a giant solar system, though. Did you see that?
Yeah, mobile solar system.
Solar system that was gigantic. And the sun had a fire element to it that would spew real fire.
Really?
As the other planets.
So the sun was alive?
Yeah.
the sun was alive. And this was a mobile device, or was it?
It was big, Alan. I can't believe you didn't see it. It was gigantic. Yeah.
But it wasn't mobile. It wasn't a vehicle.
No, it moved. It stayed. It was stationary.
But all the planets moved around.
The planets moved around it, right.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Was it in the dark room?
No, it was outside. Outside. Oh. It was really, really big.
I did see one group of kids laboriously working over this thing that looked like a giant flying wing. And it had this handmade little stenciled sign saying that it flew and then it cruised on the water and then it could go under the water too.
Really?
So I went and talked to these kids and took a picture of them with their amphibious car. Now, and it looked kind of interesting. They had motors that would rotate kind of like the Osprey, the V-22 Osprey that goes into VTOL mode and then would go into a plane mode and fly forward. And this was a model about 6 foot across.
Mm-hmm.
That these kids were working on. Their father came over and started talking to me about it. He was a real character. He's an interesting guy from China, and he's apparently a new generation of Chinese that are moving into this in tech arena. He said he had a private jet and a yacht, and it was a pain because he could only use them for maybe 6% of the time that they were around. They mostly sat unused most of the time. But if he had a craft that could both fly and cruise on the water, he would use it way more. And he was really encouraging his kids to build this because he lived in Tiburon and, you know, he could really use a craft like this.
Right. Well, I saw someone that had constructed a hovercraft out of two leaf blowers.
Oh, that's right. They're leaf
blowers. That were sitting up on end and blowing air.
Those were so fun. In fact, the rides this year, the homemade rides were just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the hovercraft you're talking about, that looked to me. Yeah, it was leaf blowers that were mounted with, you know, the blower nose pointed down to the ground through a piece of wood that was holding it vertical.
Right.
And then underneath, it looked like an air mattress had been like glued to the bottom of the wood.
Right.
And then there were some holes that let the air out more slowly than it was coming in.
Right.
And people would sit on this wood platform with the air blowers going and like spinning them in circles. It was like a ride out of Disneyland, like the
with no safety precautions.
Teacups.
And the kid sitting there with his hands up over both of his ears
because
it's very loud.
Yeah.
3D printed hovercraft toy that was popular flowing around.
I kind of love that about Maker Faire, that there's sort of, you know, there's not that hyper sense of safety that, like at Disneyland, you have to be strapped in and you have to be told like 10 times before your ride, do not leave, do not wipe your hands
I'm
and arms
sure
inside.
That the people were very concerned about safety here. It's just that they made the rides themselves. And so you did have like swings where kids were in swings that were being swung around in a circle and they were like getting lifted up in the air and it looked really scary, but I'm sure they're
but it's not.
Did you have to wear a special bracelet if you wanted to ride the rides?
You did. You had to sign a waiver. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I saw a homemade roller coaster, and then we were saying that Google had a Google Cardboard set up in a tent. So people were able to check that out.
For the uninitiated, how would you describe Google Cardboard and what is its significance?
It's a little a fold-out box that you put together as a kit, and it's got two lenses in it, a slot for your smartphone, and you download apps for your smartphone, and you get them to run, and then you put the smartphone in the Google Cardboard box, and then now you've got this viewer, like a ViewMaster, that you can hold or pass around.
And you can see a 3D
image. Yeah, it uses the position sensors in the phone to inform the app to change the point of view of the stereoscopic image that's being fed into the box and the two lenses that you're looking at. So it's a virtual reality experience, and it's the most common type of and most accessible kind of virtual reality experience. It's extremely low cost or no cost at this point. So it's kind of leading the way for people to become aware of VR and VR-like interfaces and attractions and experiences.
It's a gateway experience to virtual reality.
It's a gateway drug to virtual reality.
So it'll be another year or two before the really high-end virtual reality systems are become more popular to the public or available or able to buy. And in the meantime, people are kind of dipping their toes in the water using this Google Cardboard and other cheap little visor-based accessories, including the Samsung Gear VR, which is a $200 accessory that you can use your high-end Samsung Note 5 in. Sure. You shove your phone in it, and that's supposed to be the best mobile VR experience you can buy right now.
Have you tried that?
Yeah, it works really great. Everywhere you go to a VR event, there's people that have those that are showing it around. There was actually a big virtual reality event over the last day or two in San Jose. It started Monday, and it was Tuesday, and they did it last year, and it was literally five times the size this year.
So all the
leaders in the field and all the people that are doing all the critical work showed up. They were on panels. All the panels are online now on YouTube under Silicon Valley Virtual Reality, under the YouTube channel for the Silicon Valley Virtual Reality. And there's 6 or 7 hour YouTubes, and permeated throughout those time frames are the actual talks. So they just left the streaming camera on recording, and they just archived that up to the web. So anyone can actually go to that conference after the conference now and pretend that they paid admission and they were sitting in the audience and they got to learn and hear everybody talk about it.
So I've heard that there's a new demo from Oculus Rift, Facebook's company,
right,
that really is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's called the Crystal Cove demo. It's the current revision that they're showing. They say that the commercial version that they're going to release next year will be even better than that. So they've been on a development curve improving their characteristics of their...
What makes it good, VR?
High resolution, high frame rate, low weight, high field of view.
Not getting sick when you use it.
Fact that you have a high frame rate and a very low latency between the motion tracking and the visuals as they respond to the motion tracking, if you can get those factors fast enough, the human neurological systems that would react with nausea and other kinds of unpleasant responses will be sufficiently reduced to the point of either you're not aware that there's any discomfort or it's manageable in some way if you're very sensitive.
So nausea happens when your eyes are out of sync with your motion detectors in your body?
Yeah, it's a sensory disparity between what you see and how quickly the visuals change based on the motion that you're introducing by moving your head around. Virtual reality, by essence, is a navigable technology. So you turn your head and you look around, or you're using other kinds of input devices to steer forward or backwards.
So just as an example, we saw the demo at CES in a private room. The first thing you see, you're standing in this giant warehouse and looking far away. A full-size T-Rex comes around the corner and walks right toward you. And you have 3D sound and all that, so you hear the boom, boom, boom as he's coming.
And the roar.
And then he comes right in front of your face and opens his mouth and roars in your face and then walks right over you. So you're looking like up at his belly and looking around and watching his tail walk away on the other side. And you're like, wow,
that looks 30 feet tall, and it's right in front of you, and it walks right around you, and you're looking up and watching it.
So then it cuts
around
immediately to your you're standing on like a 120-story building right on the edge.
On a platform, looking down.
The assistant, of course, says you can jump if you like.
Yeah. And start flying.
No one jumps. I mean, I didn't jump. I don't even know what would happen if I jumped, but I didn't jump.
You'd probably hurt yourself landing because you wouldn't be expecting the floor.
And then then it cuts to you looking at in the mirror because they don't have your 3D face that you have a mask on, but it work. You know, you move as you move. You're looking in the mirror.
The biggest emerging market related to virtual reality now is diapers and barf bags.
Yeah, at least until the next rev.
Branded diapers and barf bags.
Okay, well, we'll be back after the commercial messages with Richard Cray and Greg Panos.
So you're gurgling and not Googling.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We've been talking about the Maker Faire, the phenomenal event that happened in San Mateo County Fairgrounds last weekend. It's like a World's Fair, only not so corporate. A lot of people creating their own things. Just a phenomenal assortment of creativity from our own larger community. Now, it's interesting, Richard, you had mentioned that you saw a connection between the Maker Faire phenomenon, which is huge now all over the world, and Burning Man.
That was my understanding, that it started with some of the first burners that started to age and have children, and they wanted to have a space and an event that was more family-friendly and had electricity. And
I suppose that's probably true. Sense. I know Make Magazine started with a publisher, Mark Frohnfelder. Frohnfelder, mm-hmm. Who's now over at Boing Boing. He was always interested in wired Mondo worlds of where art meets technology. And the Maker Faire, I think, was founded by Make Magazine as their kind of...
Well, they have a whole lecture series that's on all day, but all the days that they have in the theater, the main theater there are lectures going on. Mm-hmm. I saw a steampunk puppet theater, all kinds of performance, musical, and...
Certainly.
I love it.
There's so much to see.
Arts and science.
3 days is hardly enough.
I met a guy there who was doing the projection mapping of buildings, Casey Scalf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where you use a building as a projection surface, right? And then you make something interesting happen there that looks sort of sculptural.
You can make a building at night with lasers and projection, can make it become different things. It can become alive. It's an art form to turn a building into living, animated art.
Use any available surface as a canvas for light. And the light comes from a projector. The projector is fed from a computer. So you either use static imagery or video imagery or 3D computer-generated imagery. Some of the more elaborate projection mapping installations use 3D cameras or depth or sensing cameras that are integrated into the whole system. And people can wave their hands or move around in a space. That feeds a signal back to the computer image generator, and then that permutes the images that are being projected into the same space that the people are occupying. Casey was mentioning that he did a terrarium or an aquarium installation for a project or a museum where people were in the space and they were tapping on what was supposed to be the tank, and the fish were coming and swimming around, and they were all projected fish, and the tapping was being detected by a camera. Just them waving their hands. Mm. So
it's phenomenal. I mean, it makes things look fantastical.
Yeah, as long as you have your point of view calibrated to the angle of the projector, you can skew the projection in such a way that it compensates for the angle that you're looking at the surface. So in a large environment with lots of people that are all hanging out in different angles, a single projector in the center accommodates the most amount of people watching, looking at that surface. But if it's often coming in off of an angle on the side and people are in the wrong angle, then it just looks kind of skewed and it looks a little weird. The way to correct for that is to have multiple projectors projecting into multiple zones and have each one calibrated to the actual surfaces of those zones. And once they're set, You can feed it all kinds of media and stream media to it.
So Billings.
It becomes alive,
yes,
really.
So my friend Steve Davison, his title is Senior Vice President of Parades and Spectaculars for Walt Disney Imagineering Worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This weekend, they're going to debut three gigantic shows at Disneyland to celebrate the 60th anniversary of Disneyland. And they're using projection mapping heavily. They're going to projection map all of Main Street USA, all the buildings.
Wow.
At some point will be turned into jungles, waterfalls, under the sea, and the
castle. And that's just on Main Street, projections onto Main Street.
Well, that's going to Main Street and the castle, and they're going to project onto the Matterhorn as well and turn that into Mount Chugaloogie.
Oh, yeah?
This is the 60th
anniversary of Disneyland this
yeah.
year?
Wow. So, of course, they
I
do
think it's
also...
Mount Hakalugie.
Oh, Hakalugie? Is it really? I don't know.
No, he's making
it. It's from Finding Nemo, I think. So they're going to use the mountain. And then I think they're going to turn it into the frozen mountain, too. But they also do projection mapping on these giant water mist screens, too. And I mean gigantic.
Oh, onto water itself.
Water. These are just super bright projectors, right? And so they're really just changing the visual experience that you have if you're there. I guess there's also an element of it that's interactive. Is that right?
It can be. It can be interactive. They can do it on the floor space, and you walk around, and it moves and reacts to your stepping.
So it includes everything. It includes not just like projectors putting big pictures on buildings. It includes different kinds of sensors that can respond.
Yeah, performers in the space that are dancing.
Augmented reality performers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm.
I just looked up Hakalugie in the Urban Dictionary. It says you cough up and spit out a large glob of phlegm.
Jesus.
All right. I'm muting your mic, Greg.
Oh, no.
Bring it back really? To bring it back to center here.
It's supposed to be
you
funny.
Can't be serious.
Yeah. Okay, well.
I knew before you defined it.
Anybody that knows Finding Nemo knows what that is.
Finding Nemo
is the key here.
What's that?
You know, you mentioned Disneyland's 60th anniversary. I heard that there's a couple other futuristic movies coming out down there. Limitless, apparently, is having a sequel coming to television.
Really?
And so is Minority Report.
Okay.
Both of those are being turned into TV series, which is kind of interesting.
Sci-fi going mainstream, huh?
Yeah.
Episodic.
Sorry, it's Mount Wanachakalugie.
Mount Wanachakalugie. Okay,
really?
It's Wanahakalugie.
Yeah, Wanahakalugie. Whatever. I don't know.
Disney has a sense of humor.
So, yeah.
I think so.
Also, Tomorrowland. Brad Bird's film Tomorrowland is coming out.
The 22nd.
Yeah, I've seen the previews to
this.
Yeah, let's go see that.
There's a lot of mystery surrounding that, and there's some connection to the 1960. Was it 64 World's Fair?
The New York
World's Fair.
65. Yeah. 64.
Disney's connection to that.
I have a connection with the 64 World's Fair, too. Besides being there, we actually had the use of the dome from the 1965 World's Fair for the Kodak Pavilion. Kodak had a giant dome, that projection surface on the inside of it for 70mm movies in there. And we got a hold of that for a big party called the US Festival. And we used it to create the Theater of the Future. Back in the early 80s, called the Sinsonics Theater, using the dome from Kodak Pavilion in 64. So that's my connection.
That's cool. Yeah.
That was a little project with Steve Wozniak.
Future domes.
Yeah, future domes, right.
Mm-hmm. I have some old slides that my grandparents took at the 1964 World's Fair. I wanted to bring them out and scan them and see what they look like.
Well, in a sense, the Maker Fair is kind of a World's Fair.
It's the modern version of the World's
without
Fair.
Without all the corporate component.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. It's wonderful. I love it.
Well, there is corporate representation.
There's Google,
and Qualcomm and Autodesk. Yeah. And, you know, they all kick in
true.
To make sure it happens.
There's a lot, but it's overwhelmingly
But they're not selling anything, per se.
Little right. guys that are just showing off their creativity. You know,
right.
it's kind of like almost like a craft fair that's meeting industrial technology fair.
Lots of glue and solder.
Yeah, I've seen the Mythbuster boys there, too.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Tool Shop is there.
The tech shop, you mean.
Tech Shop, right, where it's a membership tool sharing group that allows people to come in and use really high-end tools.
Right, like 3D printers, lathes, 3D scanners. 3D printers.
So you don't have to buy all the stuff.
Yeah, computer animation tools.
Right. You can use it from the Tech Shop.
They had a tent
Why buy when you can borrow?
Yeah.
They had a tent that was like a Rube Goldberg maze.
Yeah.
That the kids worked on like certain stations of it all day, and then at a certain time at the end of the day they set it off, you know, let the ball go on one end, and it took like 15 or 20 minutes to go through the entire maze, and then with some grand finale that had a like 50 ping pong balls on the end of spoons that spewed them out in all directions when a bowling ball would fall down from a certain point.
Wow. That was Rube Goldberg's granddaughter showed up to like trigger it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what I heard. Yeah, Rube Goldberg's granddaughter.
I was so glad I saw that. I just happened to wander over there right about the time it was happening.
Oh, man.
In the midst of this also, I saw the biotech stuff too. It was quite fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
There was a 3D printer that was creating biotech containers and materials, ways of sequencing DNA. Lots of tools made by 3D printers for your own biotech laboratory.
Yeah, a lot of little forms, plastic forms, and have little wells and the like in them where these biomaterials have to be deposited and analyzed and mixed together.
Yeah, fascinating.
Being printed by the 3D printer now.
Yeah, this is amazing. All this stuff is suddenly available to us to play with, limited only by our own imagination and creativity.
The 3D printers that replicate things, too. They scan an object, and then they print it.
All right.
Hey, listen, we got to go.
It's been a great day. Thanks,
thanks
everybody.
For coming, you guys. Any website you want to pass on about virtual reality that you think people should check out?
Well, SIGGRAPH 2015 is coming to Los Angeles in the summer.
SIGGRAPH 2015.
Yeah, it's a big computer graphics
15
conference.
15 seconds.
Okay. Well, all right. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Alan.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Canada. Okay. Dr. Peter.
This is the Dr. Peter Show.